Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Packers Podcast. My name is Michael Cohen, and I'm here, as always, with Bob McGinn. Our podcast is brought to you by Cannon and Dunphy, and we appreciate their support. Bob, good morning.
Morning, Mike. We're at the Cohen penthouse?
Always.
In downtown GB land.
Yep.
Packerville.
Right here on, what did you call this, the main thoroughfare?
It is. Washington Street. It's where they used to have parades. They'd come from the train station in the 40s after they won their titles in the 30s. And then come bring the team over here and have a parade down Washington Street.
Where was the parade for the most recent Super Bowl?
Through Ashwaubenon, on the way to the stadium, from the airport to the stadium.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So, how you doing this morning, Bob? How's the week going?
Fine.
Yeah.
Playoff time.
You got your new Christmas present here. tell the folks about it.
It's a sweatshirt. My Christmas sweatshirt, right, Mike?
Yeah.
It's maize and it's blue.
It's the color of a bumblebee. Bob's neon yellow with blue letters right now.
It's pretty yellow.
He could walk at night without needing a reflector.
My Christmas present.
Yeah.
When I went to Michigan, everything was blue and the gold. It was a gold color. Their uniforms were gold. Now they've gone to this
Twinkie yellow.
Shock yellow.
Twinkie yellow.
And I don't really like it, but I caved in.
Okay.
My gold ones were threadbare.
You got a big game this week.
Thursday night at Mackey Arena, West Lafayette.
It's a tough place to play.
And they're coming off two defeats they got hammered by Iowa. The Boilers are going to be mad. The Riveters, as we called them in college.
Used to call them the Riveters?
Yeah, in headlines. Boilermaker Pete, they're going to be flying at Mackey, and I hope we can compete at least.
That'd be a 3-0 start for you, wouldn't it?
Boy, it'd be a steal if they could get one there. Wow. Yep.
I had some heartbreak last night on my end, Bob.
What happened, Mike?
Well, I've heard you for weeks and months now disregard all commercials by recording games. You tape them, you watch them later, you zip through them, and what? How long does it take you to get through a two-hour basketball game with no commercials?
I got my two rosters that I printed out during the day. Hour.
Okay. So you get through
minutes,
the game in an hour. Okay.
Right.
So I did that yesterday. I taped a UConn game against Temple. I successfully avoided the score all afternoon, all evening when the game was going on, despite lots of text messages from my friends and family back in Connecticut. I went to turn on the tape, and when I turned on the TV, it was already on. I think it was either ESPN or CBS Sports Network. I can't remember. And the little score line across the bottom of the screen showed me the UConn score.
The crawl got you.
And I was furious. They dropped to Temple at home. 55-53. It was a terrible effort. Temple was 6-6 coming into the game. And the Huskies had just crept back into the poll at number 23.
So, Mike, I'll just mention this. So, when you tape a game, then you must change the channel off that. Go to some default goofy channel number. That's your default. Then turn the machine off.
It was a rookie mistake.
And you got nailed by the crawl.
What would your emotions have been, Bob? Let's put this in context. Well, this wasn't a big game, but let's say you record the Ohio State game in football, and you saw the score 2 minutes before getting ready to watch that tape.
It would be brutal. I would never forgive myself. A horrible mistake. You made a rookie mistake. Veteran mistake, and I don't intend to make those.
Yeah, it was rough.
Yep.
It was rough. But how about that song? You knew that song this week, didn't you, Bob? That was a good tune.
Yeah, early high school years. Sam and Dave.
Yep.
How do you know this song, Mike?
I like Motown music.
Wow.
And that wasn't Motown necessarily because it wasn't in Detroit, but same style with those horns, the saxophones and all that stuff. And I have two connections to that song. One is that it was recorded in Memphis under the Stax record label. Obviously, I lived in Memphis for a year and a half before coming here. And then second, and I'm gonna ask you a question about this, but as some of you may know from things that I've put on Twitter, I enjoy watching the UFC and the mixed martial arts fighting. And I know I've mentioned that to you before, Bob. And one of my favorite fighters, Robbie Lawler, who defended his championship belt this past weekend, uses that song by Sam and Dave, Hold On, I'm Coming, when he walks out to the ring. Now, me and my friends who are interested in boxing or fighting or whatever, we've always wondered, if we were to fight, what song would we walk out to? What do you think, Bob? If you were in a fight, in a boxing match at Madison Square Garden, what song would you want to play as you walk out to the ring? I'm putting you on the spot.
Nothing comes to mind. I don't know.
So not Amarillo by Morning.
No. Do you got something in your brain on this one?
I don't know. I'd probably pick some pump you up rap song that would just get it going. But I don't know. We've also gone the other direction, my friends and I, because we're weird. And we've said, what would be the most strange song you could walk out to? One that your opponent would look at you and say, what in the world? And we came up with an answer.
Which is?
Sounds of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel.
Funny.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. That would really mess with an opponent's head.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, you got to think about that. And next week, we want your answer. What song would you walk out to for the heavyweight title fight? Oh, man. Well, we'll jump into it by talking about what we saw over the weekend. We saw the Packers lose to the Vikings to miss out on the division title, miss out on a home playoff game. And now we're headed on the road this week to Washington for a game against the Redskins. Bob, well, you know, what did you think going into that game? Did you think that it was going to be a clawed out grinder of a game the way that it was?
Yeah, I definitely did. Mike Zimmer, I mean, it was a huge moment for him. A lot at stake. I'll just mention this, Mike. You know, I got a few emails from people saying, oh, the Packers should just mail this one in, you know, worry about the playoffs, don't get anybody hurt. I just think that's just so wrong. Absurd, man. You play these games. Injuries happen, they happen. Who cares? To me, the division means a lot. I know it doesn't to a lot of people who are just Super Bowl fixated, but to me, division is really important. And five in a row?
That's what I was just going to say. You've mentioned it before. What would the importance or at least the historical significance of five in a row have been?
48 years of this division, Mike. And, you know, I saw it from the start. And I guess that's why. And, you know, for 22 years I've done this all-division team, so I'm really, really plugged into this division and the history of it. Bud Grant won six from 73 to 78. He won in 78 with an 8-7-1 record, including, and that's when Green Bay finished 8-7-1. They tied, I believe, but the tiebreaker went to the Vikings. The Vikings had a tie in Green Bay, and that was an overtime tie. Boy, I remember that game, standing out on the sidelines back then, the entire overtime. And there was some missed field goals, I think. I can't really remember exactly. But and Mike Ditka won five from 84 to 88. Nobody ever won four other than Mike McCarthy. He's third all time. Mike Holmgren and Mike Sherman each won three. Nobody else in the division ever won three. That's not Dennis Green or Jerry Burns or there's Tony Dungy. Nobody in those two divisions. And then they dropped it, and I think it was a real crushing defeat.
So there's no doubt that there's people within the building at Lambeau Field, some of the members of the staff or coaches or front office executives that have been here forever that certainly value the division the way that you have. But I'm just curious, what percentage of guys in the locker room who are young, who live in this modern era, who might be my age or within a couple of years of me, do you think they care at all about winning five consecutive division titles?
What percent of the people in that room, all those 53 guys, 30%? 30% have a feel for history?
Yeah, I don't think it's that much higher. I really don't.
But I do think they don't want that title going to Minnesota. You know? The five main, it may be a case where losing is more important than the winning on that one. The value of the defeat would be more than the value of the victory. So it's gone, and the Vikings have it, and they should be a contender now for a while with the Packers, and we'll see about the Lions and Bears. So the score of this game was, what was the score? I can't even remember, Mike.
20-13?
Yeah, 20-13. So the defense gave up 13 points, and you talked to a lot of these defensive players after that game. What's your impression of what they were saying and how the D played?
Well, it's sort of an interesting situation that the defense is in, and I wrote about this in my story in Monday's paper for an article written after the game Sunday night. You know, any defense would love to come in and allow 0 points in every game. If they could pitch a shutout for the entire season, that would be an A-plus, perfect game, you know, type of performance. Realistically, that's not going to happen, especially in today's NFL where, you know, quarterbacks are throwing the ball all over the place and you can't be as physical with receivers maybe as you used to be able to in years and decades past. So I asked a couple of the players. I said, "Well, what's realistic? You know, if you can't pitch a shutout every week, what's the goal then? The honest goal." And Joe Thomas, the dime linebacker, told me that it's 17. That's the number that they feel comfortable with. If they give up 17 points or less, they feel like they should win the game. Now, they've lost games where they've given up 17 points this year. They've lost games where they've given up 18 points this year. They lost this past weekend in the most important game of the season to date, having given up, as you mentioned, 13 points, because the other seven, of course, were accounted for on a 55-yard fumble return by Captain Munnerlyn. So when you look at this defense, they've essentially met their goal on at least three occasions, and they've come out on the wrong side of it three times. You know, obviously 18 isn't 17, but you get what I'm saying. They're right there three times. And so I kind of wanted to just see if they were frustrated at all, because I know this is a team, and I know that you win together and you lose together, but sometimes it's hard not to put aside feelings like one person isn't carrying your weight. We all did group projects in school. We know what it was like growing up in high school when you worked with teams and sometimes that one kid doesn't do what they're asked to do. We've all been there before, and it's frustrating. You know, to the credit of the guys in the locker room, just about everyone towed the party line and said that it doesn't really bother them. It's not a big deal. They just need to play better if they need to win the game. But there were some small tacit admissions by guys that things were different. You know, I asked Micah Hyde, how weird is it to lose games when you've only given up 18, 17, 13, especially given how prolific the offense was last year? And he said, well, it's strange. It doesn't happen around here that often, that's for sure. And if you look at the stats, the interesting thing to me was last year, and I don't have the article in front of me, I can't remember the exact stat. I want to say that last year the Packers won 8 games in which they gave up 30 or more points.
Really?
I think so.
I got a press guy.
You've got, no, it was in my story. Let me see if I can find my story real fast.
Okay.
I should be able to. But yeah, it was a wild stat. That I couldn't really believe when I read it. Let's see here. Okay, here's my story. What was the stat? Okay, here we go. So it was 20 points, not 30. Yeah, that was a mistake by me. So
you're right.
A season ago, with Jordy Nelson healthy, the offense playing well, the Packers won 8 games in which they allowed 20 points or more, not 30. Sorry, I remembered that incorrectly.
Yep.
This season, that number is 5, which isn't that far off. But then remember that 3 of those 5 came when they started 6-0. And that was another season ago. That was a different team than what we've seen now.
True.
So basically, they've won 2 with the way that they're playing now, with the offense struggling. And it's remarkable. And I mean, okay, you've seen a lot of Packers teams. With the way that this defense has played in the last 6 weeks, I have to think that it's good enough to win the Super Bowl, the defense. Given if you were to pair this defense with some of the offenses in years past, you would say that I think this is a Super Bowl caliber team. No? If you pair this defense with last year's offense, I mean, the defense is, in my opinion anyway, the defense has more than held up its end of the bargain, at least in the second half of the season.
I got to really think that through, Mike. I really haven't thought that much about the strength of this overall defense. I've been writing so much about the offense for so long here. I haven't really, to me, I don't know. I'm not sure, okay?
Okay.
I'm going to have to come to grips with that ending the season with all that grades and everything, but right now I haven't.
Okay. Now let's focus in a little bit on one particular area of the defense. What did you think of the early plan by the Vikings that was very obvious from the first series to try and isolate the linebackers of the Green Bay Packers in coverage 1 week after Jake Ryan really, really struggled in coverage against the Cardinals?
Beautiful. Beautiful plan by Norv Turner and Mike Zimmer. I mean, right off the bat, they go after Jake Ryan. They got McKinnon in the lineup. He only played 12 snaps, Jarek McKinnon. But, you know, he was this option quarterback at Georgia State.
Southern,
yeah. 4-3-7, 42 vert. I mean, the guy is a stud, man. They motion him out, don't they?
Yep, just to see if it's man or zone, like a lot of teams did earlier in the year.
And Jake Ryan, he's way out by the sideline, and Jake Ryan has to go out there in no man's land.
And I'm not going to lie, so McKinnon just took off straight down the field.
There was no double mover, nothing.
Teddy looked at him the whole way, and Ryan looked awful. I mean, he couldn't turn his hips, he couldn't run, he stumbled. It was about as ugly a single play as you can have in coverage, I think.
I mean, no linebacker in the league could run with McKinnon
right
there.
Absolutely, there's no doubt. You just got to try your best. Like McCurley said, you know, the inside linebackers coach, there's going to be terrible matchups. You just got to compete and do what you can.
So Zimmer said, I think it was in his press conference Monday, he said that they run that play all the time in practice, and Bridgewater has never missed that throw.
He overthrew it. And that was a theme early in the game, were overthrows by Bridgewater.
He was just too jacked up or too tight or whatever, and I get that. Biggest game in his NFL career. And all right, so then they matched up another young, talented player, Mykole Pruitt, Southern Illinois, rookie tight end. He's a lot faster than Kennard Backman. He was drafted before Backman. I think he was a fifth-round pick. Backman was in the sixth. And Pruitt ran a wheel route on Clay Matthews. Again, he was dead open, man.
Another opportunity, and that one would have been in the end zone. I mean, McKinnon probably would have scored a touchdown too, but you know, when the throw came to Pruitt, he was in the end zone. It was there, and it was just another poor throw.
That would have been a 21-yard touchdown. And then there was one more, wasn't there, Mike?
They matched up. They got McKinnon matched up again with Nick Perry.
That's
on that little 15-yarder on the sideline where Perry got a slight hit on the tight end and then had to retreat to catch McKinnon in the flat, and that wasn't going to happen.
Green Bay, on the other hand, has nobody to get put in any of these kind of matchups, do they?
Well, here's the thing that I was curious about, and I got this question in my chat. I can't remember. When did I chat? I'm losing track of things. It was yesterday. Jeez. When was the last time the Packers had any sort of a third down type back with speed, elusiveness, that was a threat in the passing game? I haven't been here long enough, and I haven't looked back to know, but can you think of any off the top of your head, Bob?
Cobb now. In a small little basis, right?
Yeah.
Well, Franklin would have been that. Jonathan Franklin, fourth round pick a couple years ago from UCLA. And he's a long forgotten. I kind of forgot about him, but he would have been that kind of player. And he suffered a career-ending neck or cervical, something like that, injury his rookie year. Never played again. So, you know, they took a shot on Franklin. I give him credit. Don't know if he would have been a player. He certainly looked good that day at Cincinnati in 2013, I believe. That was the end of him. Another third down back. Brandon Jackson doesn't really fit. How about Noah Heron for all of you out there 10 years ago? No,
we're really
Mattawan, Michigan, down by Kalamazoo.
We're really digging deep here, Bob.
Noah couldn't run 4.75 out of Northwestern. It's been a while since they had a back. Tony Fisher now works on the team. He really wasn't a speed back. Keith Woodside had great speed. He was a heck of a receiver. He could go out and play a wideout. He had wideout talent. He really could. Herman Fontenot came into that with Lindy and Fonny as well. Herman and Keith Woodside. I'm going back, Mike. It's getting fun now in the late 80s. And
So the answer's nobody. Is that what we're getting at?
It's been a while. I know there's somebody in there. Travis Jervey? No, I don't think so.
Would Rajon Neal have qualified if he had made the team?
He's along those lines. How about Vernon Morency, the ex-Texan? Ted acquired him in a deal. Yes, Ted made a trade for a player. Vernon Morency. He was sort of that kind of a guy.
We've gone off the rocker here, Bob.
Cedric Benson, no. He was a bellwether. Brandon Sane from the Buckeyes.
Okay.
He was here for a year. Alex Green, there's one. He could have had a chance to do stuff like this. Just didn't cut it. So now we're left with, the Pack's left with John Kuhn as the third down back, huh, Mike?
I guess so. It's strange, definitely strange to see.
Explosive.
Well, one of the defining moments there in the late in the game was on a play that actually looked like it was going to doom the Packers the way that it started. Trailing, they kicked the ball deep to Patterson, kick returner for the Vikings, Cordarrelle Patterson. And, you know, Patterson, going into the game, was labeled number one in the league by special teams coordinator Ron Zook. He thought that he's the best in the league at it. His speed is tremendous. His size and strength are tremendous. And Crosby kicked it to him all the way on the left side of the field. And then what happened, Bob?
Well, when he came across that formation, and Mike, from left to right, I guess in all these years I've seen a few returners like this. Kansas City had a big guy. I can't remember who it was about 20 years ago. I wish I had a record book, but they had a big returner. I can't remember that name. You don't have that.
You're not talking about Dante Hall, are you?
No, okay. Before that.
Okay.
A big power guy who could run. You know, Patterson's been a bust as a wide receiver. Scouts, everybody call this. You know, he doesn't have enough upstairs to really command an offense to do what needs to be done.
Did he play at Tennessee?
He was there for 4 months. They're at Florida State. I can't remember which.
Okay.
And they had Greg Jennings there his rookie year to teach him, and Jennings did a great job. I was told that. And it's just, and they tried to play Patterson for 2 years, and it just hasn't happened.
Tennessee, yeah.
Tennessee, okay. But boy, he can return kickoffs. And, you know, Crosby did a great job for three or four kicks before that. And then he had 4.07 hang and, 1 yard deep. And Patterson got on that thing. And nobody really had a shot at him. There was no missed tackle.
No, not until, I mean, Crosby was the one that ended up forcing him all the way toward the right hash. And then he had to cut back in. And then he comes inside and forces a fumble, which was, you know, probably the biggest play of the game. But, I mean, that was just, there was nobody close to him. Pure speed.
Boy, you talk about striking a blow for kickers everywhere, huh? Mason Crosby.
I know.
What a play.
Yep.
He just honed in on that thing from the side and just reached, and he had one shot.
A high school safety.
Good player. Tough guy. He's made a lot of tackles over the years.
Did you force any fumbles back in your day? You played a little safety, didn't you?
Not much.
Not much?
A little bit. What about this play by Crosby? Holy man. It was really something. And
save
Johnny
the game. Well, to a degree.
And Johnny on the spot, Hyde, what a great recovery, you know, just fetal position, textbook, just solid, man, on that ball. He's really got ball skills. And so they lost 70 yards of field position, but they had another shot to go down and win it, and alas, another failed comeback effort.
Yeah, I mean, if Patterson doesn't fumble the ball, maybe he scores, who knows, but even if he gets tackled roughly in the area where Crosby is, they're already in field goal range. They run the ball three times, they kick their field goal, it's a 10-point game, and then it's probably over anyway.
Probably. Although these games are never over in the NFL, are they, Mike?
That's true. Oh, did you think that they were going to have a shot at that Hail Mary? Did you think that it was possible that they could get a second one?
Yes, Rodgers was right there.
He really was, yeah.
It was set up exactly the one that won in Detroit was.
Yeah.
And Rhodes got up higher than Richard Rodgers, and Barr was in front of him, and Barr wasn't going to allow it to happen, but...
I'm not saying it happened on this play, because I don't know if it did. I didn't look closely enough. But would the refs ever call pass interference for jumping over a guy's back to try and bat down a Hail Mary?
Well, we went through that in Seattle four years ago, Mike, right? And some people, I can't remember, but the consensus was among refs and players and ex-players that no.
Yeah, that's one of the things, you know. And it reminds me of those plays on special teams where the gunners and they just maul on the outside, you know.
What did you see on the Janis penalty the other day? Remember he got nailed on an illegal block in the back, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, it was away from the ball, which means I didn't see it live, really, because I was following the ball. And then, you know, special teams coordinator Ron Zook was speaking on Monday, and he said he called it an overzealous penalty by Janis. So I went back and I watched it, and you can't see it on the game tape. It's not within the window of the screen. So I clicked on the All 22, which shows you every player from cameras high above the stadium, basically. And, boy, Janis with a... So he lined up as an edge rusher on the end of this punt, and he didn't get to the block. He didn't block the punt, rather. So once he didn't make the block, he turned around and ran back downfield to try and, you know, block somebody. And he just lit up one of the Vikings players 30, 35 yards away from the ball. And he got flagged for an illegal block in the back. And, I mean, he just destroyed this guy. We watched it. What did you think?
Yeah, he did. He went after him. Did he think he was going to get away with this?
I don't know. My guess is he thought that he was lateral with the guy when he made the hit, and they could say that it was from the side rather than from, I don't know.
Yeah, probably was his rationale.
Yeah. Right. But, I mean, it had no bearing on the play.
No.
That guy was so far. He was, first of all, he was 30 yards away. Second of all, he was on the opposite side from where the ball was punted. It was just Janis wanted to hit somebody.
Yeah, looks like it, right? Yeah.
Two straight games where he's had a penalty on special teams.
All right, let's talk about the other red-letter special teams play, and that would be the fake punt, Adam Thielen, 41 yards. Pick that one up, Mike.
Yeah, so basically early in the first quarter, the first drive of the game, in fact, The Vikings are in punt formation on fourth down, and they run a direct snap to is it Thielen or Thielen?
Don't know.
Okay. I think it's Thielen. At least that's what they went with on the broadcast. So they run this direct snap to Thielen, and what is he? Minnesota State?
Mm-hmm.
Is that where he's from?
Mankato State.
What did he run?
He ran well at a regional combine, 4.47.
Okay.
Yep.
So 4.47, the guy's got speed. He takes the direct snap. He goes around the left end. 41 yards later, the drive is still alive, and they got a field goal out of it.
Ron Zook had six rushers to the left to center and two to the right. He was on an overload situation. Somewhat risky business, especially with a guy like Kennard Backman over on the right side. Backman had played 26 total snaps on special teams prior to this game.
That's all.
I mean, he hasn't been able to handle any task on offense, blocking, catching, playing, assignments, anything. He's been unfit for duty, and he's been really unfit for duty on special teams, but there he is out there in a de facto division title game, and he blew it. It's a bad, bad mark.
I don't think we see him on special teams again this season, just a guess.
And Richard Rodgers, who had played some, I'm not saying he would have been in there, but he might have been. He did not play special teams in this game. Prillo was injured.
Well, Zook listed the guys that had played in Backman's spot before. He listed Janice, Starks. Who else did he list? Janice, Starks.
Banjo? No.
No? Boy, now I'm wondering. Huh. I think I wrote about this, too, in my... Let's see. When did I write about this? Oh, I remember. Okay, it was in the notes on Monday. Okay, let me pull that out. Because it was interesting. The list gives you an idea. The reason I say it's important is because the list sort of gave you an idea of how little experience Backman had compared to some of the people that have played there.
Hmm.
It got cut out due to space. I can't remember who. So yeah, it was definitely Janice, definitely Starks. I can't remember who. But anyway, it was experienced players that had been there on special teams before. So, you know, not the type that that. Not like Backman, who's, like you said, I mean, 20-something snaps on special teams, and the guy's, you know, asked to defend a fake. And he has two roles on that play, Zook said. He's asked to hold the inside guy, and then the flat is also his responsibility if anything goes on out there.
I mean, he just had poor eye discipline, and he just lost outside leverage, outside contain. It's just a terrible play. But again, it's not all on him. It's on selection of personnel. Teaching personnel.
Okay, here we go. Perillo, Starks, Crockett, Janice. So Crockett would be the only one that doesn't have a lot of experience.
Right.
But, you mm-hmm. know, there it was.
Away he goes. That led to a field goal, didn't it? Yep.
And now we got to touch on the other big move of the day. We had a new left tackle.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Obviously, they couldn't come back with Don Barclay after Arizona.
No chance.
We knew that. And I thought Treader. All along I thought Treader. And I still think it should have been Treader. Treader's not a tackle. He's a center. You didn't see him last year tackle, Mike, but he's not strong enough. He's certainly not strong enough for right. He has a better chance at left. But Treader does have feet. He doesn't have height at 6'3.5", but he has feet and he has athleticism. He's an ex-tight end. My feeling was you just put him out there and ask him to do what he can to mirror Everson Griffin. You're not going to be able to run the ball wide left, stretch outside zone stuff to the left. Probably not going to do it. So what? Their best chance to win that game was to win it with Lacy and Starks in the A gaps. Without Linval Joseph, they're undersized. They have an undersized middle backer in Kendricks. Chad Greenway is not a big dominant kind of athlete anymore, body presence. I mean, he's an older guy. He's not that stout. Tom Johnson is more of a pass rusher than a run player. Sharif Floyd is a three technique, forced to play nose without Joseph. He's not a big stuffing guy. if there was any reason not to pick the Vikings in that game, I was thinking this all week long, that it was because of their weak interior run defense. So you have sitting, you keep sitting where he is, bad back or not, whatever. You got Lindsley, okay. You got your hammer, your best, most physical center. You got Lang, and you run that until they can't handle it, and then you throw play action off that stuff.
So McCarthy's rationalization of making that move was that by putting Sitton at left tackle, Lane Taylor at left guard, and then keeping the right side in the middle the same with Lindsley, Lang, and Bulaga, that allowed him to put his best five offensive linemen on the field. So he had his strongest quintet by moving Sitton to left tackle. Whereas if you keep Sitton at left guard, he thought that the collective group of five, regardless of who you put at left tackle, would not have been as strong.
Is Taylor a better football player than Treader, regardless of position? I say it's a wash.
I think so, too. Well, Treader's got the versatility. Taylor's not bad.
He's really improved this year. He wasn't terrible in this game. But sitting at left tackle, six pressures, two bad runs, a bad back.
Two sacks.
He's somewhat short. Although he's the same height as Treader, basically. Yeah, six pressures, two sacks are in those six pressures.
He hadn't played left tackle since high school.
They couldn't overcome it. I would have gone Treader at left tackle. Ask him to mirror, forget the run game over there, run behind Bulaga, who played well, and run up that gut over and over and over again, shorten that game, make Rodgers a game manager. That was their best chance to win. Sitton could have done damage, just like they did the first game against Floyd, Johnson, and Kendricks.
How did Taylor grade out for you in the run game?
Not bad. I mean, he was okay.
Do you remember how many bad runs?
One or one and a half. Okay. But I thought he was all right. I see some sustain. You see nasty and some finish in the guy.
Yeah.
He's not bad.
No, I don't think he is bad at all.
Tom Johnson played great once he was allowed to start pass rushing. I don't know. Would it have made a difference? It could have. Treader would have had problems, too. I'm not saying he wouldn't have. He would have had problems. But his ability to mirror, I think, is a little better than Sitton's at this point.
I've gotten some questions about Lindsley at center. How did you think he played? People wonder if Treader had been playing better in his recent stretch than what Lindsley has showed back from the injury.
Mike, other than the hole, I thought Lindsley had a pretty good game.
Okay.
Yeah, I did.
I didn't see anything that made me think that he played, you know, necessarily awful or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But some fans have wondered if Treader's the better option.
Yeah. Anything else about this Viking game, Mike?
I don't think so.
So the Vikes host Seattle.
Yep. I'll pick Seattle in that game.
They got drubbed 38-7.
Did you see the weather up there?
No.
Holy cow.
What's the forecast?
The high is zero.
No.
Yeah. I just looked at it the other day.
It's the Met all over again.
Let me pull it up.
Bud Grant, shirt sleeves, zero.
The stadium's,
it's going to be awesome.
The stadium's in Minneapolis or St. Paul? I can't remember.
Minneapolis, yeah, right on the border.
Okay. I'm pretty sure.
What?
I saw something on Twitter about it. Yeah, Sunday, high is one.
Wow.
No snow, just overcast. And what else do they got? You got any wind or anything that day? Let's see.
That's the first game Sunday, like at noon, huh?
Yeah. Yep.
Wow. So who's that going to favor?
So Sunday, let's see what the actual... So it's a high of 1 degree with winds at 10 to 15 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be chilly.
Wow.
The low that night, Sunday night into Monday, is -9.
Mm. Wow. And we're going to have something like 50 in Washington, I think.
Who does that favor? Well, if Marshawn Lynch is back, you might see Lynch against Peterson. Just run it.
Yeah, Marshawn may be done for the rest of the playoffs. He gets banged up.
That's
up
true.
There.
What's the coldest game you ever played in?
Personally?
Yeah.
I mean, our season ended back then, end of October. There were no playoffs. I was never in anything colder than 25 or 30?
We played a couple really cold games in soccer.
Really?
Yeah, and I remember in middle school, I was in eighth grade, and we played a game think the wind chill was like negative 15.
Wow.
It was in late October, early November, freezing cold. The temperature that day was only like, you know, 5 or 10 or 12 degrees. It wasn't awful. I mean, that's still pretty cold, but there was like 25 mile an hour winds. It was brutal. God, that was the cold. And it was little snow flurries, not much, but that was one of the coldest games I've ever played. I've also played in a hailstorm. That sucked, but that was in the summer.
Hail?
Yeah, thunderstorm with hail.
You kept playing? Yeah.
Yeah, we played through it. Yeah. Because there wasn't lightning, it was just thunder. But yeah.
I played in a monsoon in Munising, Michigan.
Really?
Hard by the shores of Lake Superior. People have ever been to the field in Munising with these big hills and all the water just would run down these hills onto this crummy field.
Yep.
Just the field was a pile of mud piles everywhere.
When I was about 10 or 12 years old, we played a game where there was a chance of snow that day, and it happened where, I'm sure you've seen storms like this, Bob, where in like an hour it just comes down with 3 or 4 inches real fast. Just a bucket all at once, and we played in that. So by the end of the game, there was 4 or 5 inches of snow on the field. So that was something.
Interesting.
But yeah, that's all we got for the Vikes. We will take a short break for a word from our sponsor. We'll return and take a look ahead at Washington.
At Cannon and Dunphy, we're proud of our winning reputation. We're also proud to be the exclusive sponsor of the excellent Journal Sentinel coverage of our great football team. I'm Bill Cannon. To learn more about our winning team, go to our website.
So we're on to Washington, Bob.
We are. I haven't been there since October of 2010, Mike.
I got stuck in a snowstorm there about a year and a half ago. Spent 5 days in a hotel.
In Landover?
No, downtown D.C.,
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The Crystal Palace area, I think it's called.
I asked you this question. I said, who was the Skins starting quarterback in that game in October of 2010? And you did not have the answer.
No, I guess wrong, like 4 times.
The great Donovan McNabb. And they defeated the Packers in OT. And after that game, Mike Shanahan said he thought that's one of the best pass rushes he had ever seen. That was led by Mike Neal, rookie, Cullen Jenkins, Clay Matthews. It was a heck of a rush on McNabb that day, and he threw a long bomb to some guy by the name of Armstrong, and they won the game 19-16. Graham Gano kicked the winner.
Was Jenkins good when he was here? He had a really good season for the Giants this year. Played well.
Did he?
He was one of their stronger linemen. They were killed by injuries with Pierre Paul out for a long time.
I thought their whole defense was so horrible.
Well, it was, but he played okay, I thought.
Did he? Okay. I'm glad to hear. He's a terrific guy.
Nice guy?
Yep. All right, the Redskins, 9-7.
9-7.
One-point favorite.
Yep, won the... Oh, really? I didn't see that.
Yeah.
Okay, they won the NFC East.
They've won 4 in a row.
Yes, they have, and they won 5 out of 6.
They've played 2 playoff teams. They got drilled at New England, 27-10, and they got drilled at Carolina, 44-16. The only other team with a winning record was the Jets that they've played. They got beat at the Jets, 34-20. So the NFC East was everybody was below, didn't have winning records, and that's just the way it goes. So they're 9-7. They've been in the playoffs 5 times in the last 23 years. Green Bay will be making their 18th appearance in the last 23 years. All right, let's look at the Redskin offense. It's the Kirk Cousins show. Kirk Cousins out of Michigan State, 7-9 record his first 3 years, 77 passer rating. He has exploded down the stretch. He's become decisive, confident, accurate, led the league in accuracy, 69.8%. Scout yesterday was saying how he's always been able to, he always thought he could spin a really good ball, even at Michigan State. He's got a pretty darn good arm. He can complete every ball, and he's got weapons galore.
In the last 4 games, he's got 12 touchdown passes. It's taken Rodgers the last 8 games to throw 12 touchdown passes.
He's been over 100 the last 6 games.
Yep.
He's a factor.
No doubt.
A big factor. Colt McCoy was given the job over Cousins late last year because of Cousins' many mistakes. Then McCoy hurt his neck. RG3 is 3 here and a non-factor. All right, the weapons. Tight end Jordan Reed, 87 catches, second in the league among tight ends. 4.71 coming out, but he plays faster than that. Over routes, boots in the flat, yards after the catch. He's an oversized wide receiver, and he's really a problem. You line him, you cover him with a linebacker, you're asking for it. You just can't do it. You got to switch up on this guy. problem is they got three other weapons too, and it's somebody's going to get one-on-one. DeSean Jackson, former Eagle, 29 years old, but he can still run like the wind. He tracks those deep balls. He just plain runs deep, flat takeout, double moves, over routes, deep boots. He gets deep, and he makes plays. He's got four touchdowns this year. He came back from a hamstring at midseason. He's got four long bombs in the last six games. All right, Pierre Garçon, the old Colt, 113 catches in 2013. This year, not nearly as productive, 72. But, I mean, there's only one ball on the field, you know. A muscle guy. He's not as fast as he used to be at a 4.42 coming out, but he's a muscle guy, strong hands. Just made a terrific catch against the Cowboys on a long touchdown. Snatched the ball, speared it over his head. Tremendous stuff. Garçon is he's a little bit like Anquan Boldin. He'll physically try to get after corners in press area. You can't get too close or he will knock you off his feet. And the next one, the slot, is rookie Jamison Crowder of Duke. 5'8.5", Mike.
I think he's a good little player.
He's a very good little player.
He's got 59 catches, 604 yards, and two touchdowns this season. He's coming off a really good game against Dallas.
He gets this ball in these Dallas. It was just north and south, just instant. And tough little guy, really a savvy, smart player. He gets all these one-on-ones, you know, and who's ever going to be doing that? This is a good player.
Fourth-round pick.
Yeah, Scott McLuhan really hit that one. Okay, that's their weapons. You know, Rashad Ross caught a 71-yard touchdown against the Cowboys. He's number four. And Ryan Grant's not all that bad either. He was a third or fourth-round pick.
How about the backs?
Well, one thing on the tight ends, they have three other good tight ends.
Oh, okay.
Niles Paul and Logan Paulson, the blocker. Paul's a heck of a receiver. They both suffered season-ending injuries in August. And then they got Derek Carrier, the guy from Beloit College in Edgerton, Wisconsin. Carrier's up to 250, and he became a heck of a blocker. Nobody would realize that who saw him in college. I saw him play St. Norbert. But this guy was really playing well with like 20 catches, and he suffered, a blown knee. He's out for the year. So they got no backup tight end. They took an old guy, Alex Smith, off the street, 10-year vet. All right, the running backs?
Yeah.
Alfred Morris. He's a zone stretch runner, off-tackle guy, Florida Atlantic. Had a great first three seasons. Scouts say he's lost something, Mike. He took a lot of hits, a lot of touches, and he's not as special. You don't see that burst right now. They're splitting time with him with Matt Jones, which is an indication, again, that Morris has lost just a little bit. Jones, he's a big maybe
back.
The tallest back in the league, 6'2.5", 237.
No, we played the tallest back in the league.
Who's that?
Latavius Murray.
How tall was he?
6'3.5".
6'2.5", officially.
6'3".
Tie. what's Stark? 6'1.5"?
I don't know what Stark says.
I forgot. You need the official heights, Mike. You can't look up that combine stuff on there. All right. Matt Jones got five fumbles, lost four. That's a problem. Morris does not fumble. Pierre Thomas, the old Saint. I love this guy. Tremendous screen runner, always has been. Saints got rid of him. I think he played in Seattle maybe for a month. Scott McLuhan picked him up. He had a big game here 2 weeks ago against the Eagles. That's their skill position. All right, the offensive line. They got an aircraft carrier, left tackle, Trent Williams, one of the best in the biz.
That's a good description.
Left guard, Spencer Long. He's a tough, nasty guy. He's not a great player, first-year starter, but I remember all these scouts before the draft talking about this guy. He's a finisher. He gets after you. The center, they just activated Corey Lichtensteiger from temporary IR, and I think he's going to start. No announcement yet, but I think he'll get his job back over Josh Laribius, a player from SMU, a real big, girthy guy, again, kind of a non-athlete, inconsistent with a shotgun snap. Lichtensteiger is a small guy, 6'2", a little bit under 300, but he's been around. He started 80 games, pretty good player. They drafted Brandon Scherff in the top 10 last year, the guy from Iowa, and he was going to be their right tackle. But within 10 days of training camp, Jay Gruden and McLuhan decided that he wasn't going to, the arms were short, the height's not great, that he should be a guard. And he immediately moved to right guard, and he's been solid there ever since. He's a good player. You don't want to take a guard with a pick that high, but it's the way it goes. And they've made the most of it, and they got that control, that position set for the next 10 years. The big surprise has been Morgan Moses, an underachieving guy from Virginia Cavaliers. Moses, a very highly discussed player before the draft 2 years ago. They took him in the third, I believe. Long arms, a lot of athletic ability, finesse guy all the way. But now he's been matched with Bill Callahan, an esteemed offensive line coach for almost three decades, former Badger assistant, former Raider head coach. And you can see now Moses is starting to get a little physical, and he's playing pretty well. So that's their old line. Interesting, this Ty Neschke guy out of Texas State, a free agent, he played left tackle when they sat Williams against Dallas. And this Neschke guy, again, I assume with Callahan's heavy influence, he played really well against Greg Hardy. That's their all. They rank pretty good. That's the strength of their team.
Okay, what do we got on the other side of the ball?
Joe Barry, a first-year coordinator, came from the Chargers. He runs a 3-4 one-gap scheme, mostly zone in the back end. Pressures a lot on third down. And I mean empty pressures, no safety. He'll just send everybody who's not covering. All right, the front. If they're allowed to sit in a 3-4, they're going to stop your run. They're all big, huge guys. But against Green Bay's 3-wide look, you're going to get a lot of these fat people out of the lineup, and people are averaging 4.8 per carry against them. You can run against their sub stuff. Well, the most famous name here is Terrence Knighton. Pot roast, right? Pot roast. He was a big hit at the Super Bowl a couple years ago with Denver. Overplayed his hand in free agency coming out of Jacksonville last year. Yeah, Jacksonville.
I think so.
Signed a one-year deal for $3.55. Thought he was going to get more. All right, Knighton. He's listed at 354. One opposing assistant coach swears he's 380. Mike, wait till you see him. He's 6'3". He cannot move.
380 is three of me.
Yeah. He looks at...
More than three of me.
He looks at Mike.
Well, just about.
Not quite three.
Not quite.
Right.
God, that's an enormous human being.
He can't move, but he can't be moved. So he's just the ultimate space eater.
You got to double team him?
Phone booth guy. But just run away from him. He's got no range. But you forget the A-gaps this week. That ain't happening.
You can
write that off.
What do you think he would run right now in the 40?
Could he
get under six?
He came out at 3:16. I was looking at this yesterday, and I think he ran 5.12. He's got some athletic.
It's better than I thought it was going to be.
Third-round pick, I think. Now? Oh, my. 6'5"?
Oh, jeez. 6'5"?
Maybe. Wait till you see this.
God, okay.
All right, Chris Baker. It took him 5 years to start his first game. You know what? The guy's really a pretty darn good player. He's 325, and he does have some ability to penetrate and get up on the passer. He's not bad. Jason Hatcher, 33 years old, a former Cowboy. You know, he's got a lot of athletic ability. Now, he's lost a lot of it, and he's right near the end. Bad body, aches and pains. But Hatcher, he's got more quarterback pressures than anybody on the team. Mike, he's got 32 pressures.
Wow.
And this guy, he hasn't played all that much, but Jason Hatcher can hurt you with the pass rush. All right, the backups. They lost Stephen Paella, the former Bear, about a month ago to injury, season ending. They got Ricky Jean-Francois, the old 49er Colt. Decent. They got Kedrick Golston, a 10-year Redskin. Going way back, probably had five head coaches. And Golston is a pocket pusher as well. They're bull rushers, and they're pretty good against the run in base. All right, that's the front. On the 3-4, their best player on defense is Ryan Kerrigan, who will be on the open side. He's from Purdue. They paid him a heck of a lot of money with an extension. He is a leverage, power, relentless motor rusher. Speed's just okay. But he's a threat. On the other side, you got Trent Murphy, a Stanford hard-charging guy. Sets the edge well, power rusher, only runs 4.85. Their better player over there is Preston Smith, a second-round pick this year. Most people thought he was going to be a 4.3 DE, But here he's standing up. McLuhan took a shot at him standing up, and it's worked. And he's really come on as a pass rusher. More sacks than anybody in the league, 8. A little bit more than Danielle Hunter, who had 6. Smith is another good rush threat to join Kerrigan. That's outside. Inside, they made a switch about 6 weeks ago. They benched Keenan Robinson and Perry Riley, in effect. And are they going with Will Compton, a hard-charging, feisty former free agent from Nebraska? Runs pretty good. He's small, but, he's, a big leader guy. And Mason Foster, a former starter with the Bucks. McLuhan got him off the street. He's okay. The secondary is a mess. This is where they're most vulnerable. Of their top 6 guys who would be on the field and sub, 3 are on IR. Breshad Breeland would be the nominal number 1 corner. He's really not that good. You got Will Blackman, the former Packer, now pressed into duty as the starter on the other side. Smart and tough, gives up a ton of completions. The nickelback, it could be Kerry Williams, who was signed Tuesday, started against the Packers early in September for Seattle, cut by Seattle December 7, blew too many things, too slow. He could be on the field. The safety is D'Angelo Hall, the old corner, moved to safety at midseason. A ball hawk, smart. He's really tackling better than you thought he would as a career corner moving inside. And Deshaun Golson, the old Buck 49er, a very intimidating kind of hitter on his last legs. They got problems in the back end. Jerron Johnson, a free agent signing from Seattle, major disappointment. He's their third safety. Special teams, they got a good kicker, Dustin Hopkins, who probably won't give Jeff Janis any returns. He booms him out of there. Tress Way is a good left-footed punter. Crowder's just okay on punt returns. Rashad Rotz is a bit of a threat on kickoffs. Fullback Darrell Young is their best special teams guy. That's them, 9-7. Are they a good team? Not really.
No.
They can be beaten.
They can put up points, though.
Against bad defenses, they can.
True.
I mean, they're beatable. Of the 4 people I polled, 2 assistant coaches and 2 scouts, all of them took the Packers.
Really?
4-0.
Close games?
4, 7, or 8. I know a lot of Packer fans are writing this baby off as a defeat. They're crazy. They're just caught up in all this, anxiety or disappointment or whatever. But the team's 10-6, and the experts think they're going to win this game. They're on the road. Road's not really important in the playoffs. That's not a hard place to play. So we'll see. We'll see if they have it in them.
All right, we'll take a short break for a word from our sponsor, and we'll return and take a couple questions from you guys.
At Cannon and Dunphy, we're proud of our winning reputation. We're also proud to be the exclusive sponsor of the excellent Journal Sentinel coverage of our great football team. I'm Bill Cannon. To learn more about our winning team, go to our website.
All right, we've arrived at the part of the show where we take a couple questions from you readers and listeners. The first question comes from David Kaiser. David, thank you for asking a question. David wants to know, is Clay Matthews going to start at outside linebacker this week? Am I crazy?
I think so. If he started at outside backer, he'd be against Trent Williams. And without having a whole lot of practice time and game time out there, I don't think he'd get a whole lot done against Trent Williams.
Agreed.
And if he did start outside, you'd have Palmer with Jake Ryan inside and Joe Thomas.
I don't think that's enough to win a playoff game.
They'd be running that zone stuff all day long. They need Matthews to help out on Jordan Reed from inside and to help stop the run game.
And I think what you just said is really important, Jordan Reed, because maybe they cover him with Hyde, maybe they cover him with Burnett, maybe they cover him with Matthews, but they've used Hyde against a lot of tight ends this year, and I don't know if that's necessarily going to work against Jordan Reed.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Okay, Michael. This is from Paul Komorowski, and Paul writes, the fake punt by the Vikings was inexcusable. Shades of Seattle last year. Has Ron Zook done enough to be back?
Whether or not the fake punt was a major mistake by the coaching staff or an incorrect play by Kennard Backman, whatever you want to chalk it up to, I still think that to say Ron Zook has not done enough this season is inaccurate. I think he's actually done a very nice job with special teams. Think about Think about the different options they've had to deal with. They lost their number one kick returner in Ty Montgomery. They had a number two kick returner, Micah Hyde, that was then injured and had to be replaced. So now they're with Jeff Janis. They've done a nice job of turning him into a dangerous returner at times. Punt returns have struggled. There's no doubt about that. But the coverage units have been terrific. Crosby has been as steady as ever. Think about the resurgence of Tim Maste, considering how awful he was during training camp. Think about the integration of a new long snapper. I think Zook has done a fine job this season, and I'd actually be surprised if he wasn't back next year. That's my two cents on that one.
Sounds good.
Well, we've definitely gone way beyond the 50-minute mark, which is always our cue to leave. So we thank you all for listening once again. We'll talk to you. We'll do an end-of-season podcast, won't we?
Yeah, Not sure when, but we'll do it.
We'll do an end-of-season podcast. Until then, enjoy the sounds of Sam and Dave.
It's on Old DC.
All right, we say thank you to our sponsor, Cannon and Dunphy, and we'll talk to you guys later. Oh, no.